Pariyatti Audiobooks presents Chapter 4, Scott and Helen Nearing, from the book Cultivating Inner Peace by Dr. Paul Fleischman, as read by the author.
Chapter 4, Scott and Helen Nearing. If you spend a pleasant hour or afternoon in your favorite pastime, you will be able to observe your pleasure cease as a product of one of two causes. Something outside you may change the conditions necessary to your pleasure, or an internal feeling may disrupt you. To live a life of peace, you need a way to restore the peace you've had and lost, to internal or external change. Peaceful living is learning to change with the changes. In this section of the book, I'm focusing your attention on the need for a dynamic relationship to your mood and your idea of peace. Lifetimes of peace derive from flexible, problem-solving commitments that reassert peace as the core goal in the solution of your current problem, whether that problem be inner or outer, hunger or war. One intriguing example of this dynamic process is the life of Scott and Helen Nearing, organic gardeners who inspired thousands of people to live lives honed by simplicity and peacefulness. These green mountain leprechauns grew powerful by following the ideal of personal and communal peace. They drew inspiration from their imagination, casting themselves as explorers for humanity. The longer they lived, the more arduous the conditions they set for themselves, like mountain climbers seeking higher peaks. Their life history reveals the role of centering focus, eternal return, tensile realignment, by which lives of peace steer across the ocean of temptation, dissatisfaction, and distraction, to stay true to an internal glowing light. Scott Nearing started life as a professor of economics at the prestigious Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, but was fired in 1915 for openly opposing child labor. During World War I, this premature curmudgeon was put on trial for opposing the war, but was acquitted. No university would hire such a troublesome individualist despite his successful publications. He married a musician 21 years his junior, and in 1932, when Scott was already nearly 50 years old, he and Helen moved to Vermont and bought, for a song, the most isolated and run-down farm they could find. The Nearings moved to a high, cold region of Vermont where electricity and flush toilets were still unknown, and buying up abandoned farm property at the height of the Great Depression, they commenced a radically new life. We thought of the venture as a personal search for a simple, satisfying life on the land, to be devoted to mutual aid and harmlessness, with an ample margin of leisure. The Nearings self-consciously rejected and intended to correct the dominant world culture of 1932, which was gripped by depression and unemployment, falling prey to fascism, and on the verge of another world war. They wanted to root their life in pacifism, vegetarianism, and collectivism, and demonstrate one possibility of living sanely in a troubled world. On Forest Farm in Vermont, and later in Maine, over a period of more than 40 years, enduring into very old age, the Nearings persisted in quiet, steady triumph. They wrote with deep personal satisfaction of respect for life, simplicity, a quiet pace, with time to wonder, ponder, and observe. We hope to replace worry, fear, and hate with sincerity, purpose, and at-oneness. The Nearings created no more than they needed and refused to accumulate savings. Their food came from a brilliantly informed, ceaselessly experimental, and diligently run garden farm. They cut their own fuel wood. Their economic independence not only gave them a closeness to soil and seasons, it also guaranteed freedom of thought. Their life was a blend of agrarian idealism coupled to mastery of contemporary contingencies. After more than half a life as urban intellectuals, they built spacious, beautiful buildings that have endured after them, working with their own hands and no power tools. This ingenious output was only half their life. The other half was devoted to literary and artistic self-development and to dialogue with thousands of transient guests and admirers. Their Puritan strenuousness was only a foundation over which they built a skylight life of daring and play. They preserved and exulted in the boy and the man, and the girl and the woman. When Scott was in his 80s, he dug out a farm pond by hand, counting 15,000 wheelbarrows full of mud. A sinuous old cyclone. Energetic assault on every problem marks their account of their life. In spite of the almost compulsive hustle in collecting stones, building houses, keeping up with the seasons in their garden, the Nearings exuded a sense of sociability and full-heartedness, becoming hosts to a generation. Although they tried to outline a practical philosophy that guided their life and that other people could follow, they found a life that was personal and idiosyncratic, a homemade grandparent stew. It was emblematic, but not exemplary. They progressed through a discrete series of dynamic solutions to the problem of how to attain inner peace, as the problems arose in their own particular historical moment and context. Their blend of socialistic, agrarian, New England, intellectual, literary, teetotaling hypomania is unique to them. I'm not recommending an imitation of their lifestyle, nor implying that its surface features would lead everyone to peace. Their methods were pied, homespun, and sweaty. But their goals and gratifications were gold thread in a wizard's tapestry. It is their essence that we need to follow. They lived with ceaseless energy, concentration, an expansive sense of the future, and a pragmatic attention to concrete details. We took our time every day, every month, every year. We had definite goals that each moment, hour, day, week, and year should be treated as an occasion, another opportunity to live as well as possible. We should live as decently, kindly, justly, orderly, and efficiently as possible. It is better to love, create, and construct than to hate, undermine, or destroy. As day-to-day training for a new way of life, our project was a real success. The Nearings coupled a deep inspiration towards peaceful living with a dynamic sense of the process itself. They hand-carried field stones into piles, turned the piles into walls and houses, and when retirement time came, they decided that the ski boom had made Vermont too crowded, so they moved to Maine to recommence. Their tenacity was malleable. They built, changed, expanded, innovated barns, houses, guest rooms, and storage sheds. Every solution was temporary, but the goal was not. They sought new answers to one problem with conviction and strength. The value of doing something does not lie in the ease or difficulty, the probability or improbability of its achievement, but in the vision, the plan, the determination and the perseverance, the effort and struggle which go into the project. Life is enriched by aspiration and effort. "We have no time to spare," they told a visitor. "But what do you do for pleasure?" they were asked. "Anything and everything we do yields satisfaction. What we have been doing is to meet a series of challenges, each in its own time and at its own level. Some of them dealt with our basic assumptions. Others involved minor practical details." True to their austere and august beliefs, the Nearings donated rather than sold most of Forest Farm to the town as a nature preserve, keeping merely enough money to purchase a new, isolated, run-down place in Maine. Their mastery of financial anxiety, which overlaps fears of illness and helplessness, was Olympian. Even Thoreau stayed at Walden only 2 years and spent most of his life in his mother's home. Deeply knowledgeable of and inspired by their antecedents, another crucial pattern of peaceful living, the Nearings quoted an ancient Chinese poem. "When the sun rises, I go to work. When the sun goes down, I take my rest. I dig the well from which I drink. I farm the soil that yields my food. I share creation. Kings can do no more." The Nearings demonstrated, though they did not fully understand, that peace is not one particular historically conditioned complex of political, social, economic, or dietary platforms. Peace is a great determination in rebalancing peace. The Nearings exemplified dynamic return to peace. Energy in pursuit of it, optimism in renewing it, pragmatism in fulfilling it, courage in holding true to it, and wisdom in studying the spiritual ancestry of the peace they sought. These are as essential in the city as in the hills of Vermont and will lead you towards the Nearings' enviable peerage with kings. The Nearings story reveals the assiduous attention that is essential to cultivating inner peace. However, absolute fixation on inner peace will not yield fulfillment. That is why I have emphasized the motile, fluid, absorbing quality of peace. If we consider religious orthodoxy, I can clarify this point. In all religions, there are centering self-disciplines that turn attention inward, diminish engagement with mundane and secular pursuits, and lessen distraction by fixating the mind upon an object of devotion. Despite a superficial similarity of appearance, there is a vast difference between orthodoxy and peacefulness. In the former, an obsessive, repetitive ritual forms a barrier against the problems of survival. The devotee memorizes, intones, and blocks out the world and his own fears and desires, which are forcefully extruded from or denied consciousness. there is a willed repression of sex, violence, illness, and death. This determination to blot out complexity brings temporary solace, but as soon as the ritual ceases, or the sealed crypt of seclusion is broken, the Orthodox worshiper is flooded by realities unmastered. Avoidance triggers a subsequent anxious reaction to whatever had been left unsolved and undone. Having been driven underground, yearnings and anxieties rise up like rebellious, uncontrollable armies. As soon as the monotonic deadening of obsessively preoccupying ritual ends, the true believer must fight back, beat down all he fears and cannot control in himself and in the world. He is unprepared to deal with his own urges and with critical, dangerous circumstances, and therefore seeks to impose upon himself and others a rigid, repeating order. The way to peace looks similar on the surface, but is opposite to orthodoxy. A multifaceted, engaged living extends through the necessities and ways of the world, yet returns to peace continuously, like a foraging bird to its evening nest. Constantly exposed to the world, continuously aware of our own inner reaction to the welter of conditions, we faithfully seek the light in the darkness, the stillness beneath the wind. Rather than obliterate the world and the inner life it stirs in us, we attune our awareness of them at the same time that we channel, direct, guide this awareness towards the point of peaceful living. The Nearings, ascetic as they were, had the comfort of each other's bodies. They eschewed money, but produced sugar, starch, and protein. They played music daily and flung open their doors to the world. They practiced peace that was like a garden annual, requiring continual replanting, crowned with a marigold. Peace is the result of a solution, getting things to mix and flow. It's a direction, not a station. Peace is not a possession. It is confidence, like planting tulip bulbs in autumn. Don't look for something mature and archaic. Peace is the mood of continuous loss and rebirth. The reformation of peace is outdoors, beyond walls, among the vernal and the tremulous. The Nearing's life captures the middle path necessary for inner peace, utilizing their capacity for risk-taking, courageous leaps out of confinement towards peace-bearing personal freedom, but rerooting in the ordered, regularizing calm of daily toil in the service of a steadying goal. They relocated, but they never shifted their gaze. The Nearings were atheists, but spiritual in their reverence for mundane tasks. The exuberant detail with which they wrote about building techniques or systematic gardening was so narrow-minded and precise that it formed a blade to cut through the minutiae in which they were absorbed. They whittled on the pragmatics of bliss. The mood of their prose and of their lives was effervescent with infectious delight. After filling pages with concrete details appropriate for a gardening magazine, they penned this simple refrain. We, at advanced ages, are still questioning, investigating, searching, and aiming to build a more rewarding and more creative life. There were two major moves in the Nearings' lives. The first was when they left urban life in 1932. The second move was when they threw off the yoke of their own beautiful handmade stonework farm in Jamaica, Vermont, and moved to Maine, despite the fact that Scott was already almost 70. Of the two moves, the first was the one that plummeted them into unprecedented activity and fame. But the second move is what makes them symbols of a psychic process, the way that Odysseus stands for wandering and Einstein stands for mathematical scientific thought. When Scott was 90, he and Helen began to build by hand their new stone home. When Scott was 95, he and Helen wrote, "Never for a moment did we sit back and say to ourselves, 'This is it. We've arrived.'" They unconsciously echoed Martin Buber's comment, "To be old is a glorious thing when one has not unlearned what it means to begin." Their ebullience was independent of conditions. Overcoming was itself the source of their verve. They didn't retreat before the physical decline of age because they construed their task as builders, not owners, experimenters, not maintainers, flowers, not fruit. They understood their quest for peace as a continuous process that was fulfilled only in ongoing outpouring, not in storage. "To us," they wrote in old age, "life was real, vital, urgent, important." Notice how different peace is from contentment. Contentment is a temporary, static ease. For the Nearings, inner peace was a particular quality of motion, a day-long, lifelong farmer's pace, like a slow gathering of stones. They thought of peace not as anything that was done, but as immersion in just and hearty doing. They quoted approvingly Robert Louis Stevenson, "To travel, hopefully, is better than to arrive." Their lives epitomized the psychic fact that inner peace spoils on the shelf. Peace is not a particular social or economic solution, not pickles in a jar, but an atmosphere enveloping a lifelong series of active solutions. The Nearings published at their own cost Living the Good Life, which appeared obscurely in 1954, but was reissued with fanfare in 1970. It became the Bible of the Back to the Land movement, selling hundreds of thousands of copies. In 1979, they provided a sequel, Continuing the Good Life, which was published when Scott was 95 and Helen 74. They told their story with matter-of-fact understatement, yet like the Pied Piper, they drew a following because the facts of their existence revealed admirable accomplishment in the direction of sane and simple living. Like Jungian archetypes, they had gained entry into thousands of people's dreams. Scott Nearing died in 1984 at the age of 100. Helen continued homesteading and attracting admirers, 1 to 2,000 a year, until her death in 1995. The habit of peace is a form of grace that extends into the future, beyond pending death, which is only another move north to new plowed land. Because peace can't be grasped or held constant, faith in its possibility and resolution to actualize it are its recurrent preconditions. The dynamism of peace precludes absolutism, rigidity, finality. Peace isn't accomplished, never endures beyond a moment, and must be reborn, recreated in the next. Peace is atomic.
Pariyati, a non-profit 501c3 organization, offers a wide variety of books, e-books, videos, and audiobooks about the teachings of the Buddha, the Pali language, and Vipassana meditation. Browse our complete catalog at www.pariyatti.org. That's pariyatti.org.